Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments.
Good afternoon, everybody. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to the Vox Pop for this Monday, June 11th. I'm Alan Shartok. Underwriting support for Medical Monday comes from Saratoga Hospital Medical Group, the multi-specialty practice of Saratoga Hospital, with 27 specialty practices and more than 170 providers taking care of their community, saratogahospital.org for more. Joining us today is Dr. David Hart of Albany Medical Center, a neurologist. Dr. Hart is here to answer your questions about dementia and memory loss. It's going to be a busy hour, so be sure to get your calls in early before you forget. The number is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Dr. Hart, and your calls all coming up on the Vox Pop right after this news. Hello once again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Shartok. Joining us today is Dr. David Hart of Albany Medical Center. He's here to discuss dementia and memory loss. Dr. Hart treats diseases of the brain, spinal cord, nerves, and muscles. Some of the more common problems that he diagnoses and treats are dementia, strokes, epilepsy, headaches, multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's disease. He's been part of the Alzheimer's Center at Albany Med since 2015, and in more than 20 years of private practice prior to that, he has overseen numerous clinical trials on Alzheimer's treatment locally. He's associate professor of neurology at Albany Medical College. Dr. Hart, welcome to Medical Monday.
Thank you, Alan. I'm glad to be here.
Well, the last time you were here, you caused quite a stir. A lot of people called up.
It's all my fault.
Which it certainly is. And I'm sure we'll see that again today. The phones are already beginning to ring. Is there anything new in the Alzheimer's sun?
Well, I think the big thing is that for the last 20 years, we've been, for many years, we've been pushing for a definitive cure for Alzheimer's. The last 20 years, the focus has been targeting a protein called amyloid protein, which builds up in the brain, we think, starting the cascade of events that causes Alzheimer's. Now we're starting to turn towards other strategies, both because the amyloid therapies have not been very successful and because some other things are looking very promising. So I think that's the news of the day.
Okay. Well, if it's all right with you, Doctor, we'll take the first call from Jim in Matamoras, Pennsylvania. Okay, Jim, you're on. Go ahead.
What effect does this substance derived from jellyfish have on the neurological system?
Well, I think I know the substance you're talking about, which is advertised very heavily on TV.
Right.
And this is something which, in the one trial that they did, which I think involved 80 or 85 patients, showed that it was pretty well tolerated, but that it did show some clinical benefit. But you have to understand that this was what in clinical trial lingo would be termed a phase one trial. So it's really just kind of a proof of concept trial to make sure that it's not horrendously toxic, and to maybe get some preliminary idea of what kind of doses to look at when you're doing studies aimed at showing whether it really can be beneficial or not. So the benefit that they saw is not, unfortunately, predictive of how it would turn out if they were to do a large, adequately sized trial. We've seen dozens and dozens of agents which have looked great in similar trials, but when they've gotten to bigger trials have crashed and burned. So I don't think at this point there's any real evidence to support its use. And I think patients should be focusing their funds and their efforts elsewhere.
Thanks, Jim. Let's go to Ed in Wilbraham. Ed in Wilbraham, you're on.
Good afternoon, doctors.
Good afternoon.
My question involves Benadryl, and I'm wondering how strong is the connection between the use of Benadryl and dementia? And in addition to that, I'm wondering if you've been using it for a while. Is it reversible, anything that may have been done?
Well, I think it's an interesting question, and it's probably a hard one to give an exact answer to. But Benadryl or diphenhydramine is an anticholinergic. So the way that it exerts its effect to help you get to sleep or to help fight rashes and itching is by blocking the effect of a neurotransmitter called acetylcholine. Most of the neurotransmitters in the body serve many different purposes, and acetylcholine is no different. It turns out that in addition to being important for things like itching, that acetylcholine is an important chemical in the brain for memory and attention.
Wow.
The medicines that have been on the market, the majority of the medicines that have been on the market for treating Alzheimer's disease, Aricept, Exelon, and Reminyl, are medicines that increase the amount of acetylcholine in the brain. So if you think about taking something which blocks the effect of this important neurotransmitter, it's easy to understand how that might have an adverse effect on brain function and especially on memory and attention. On the other hand, getting your sleep is important. I usually recommend that people think about using something like melatonin. There are some other non-diphenhydramine-containing agents that may be helpful for getting to sleep. We try to keep people away from really sedating medications if possible, especially if they're having memory difficulties. But so I guess the bottom line is that there is a link. It makes sense that there should be one, and I try to get my patients to avoid using Benadryl or similar medicines.
Thank you, Ed. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. And we go to Lenore in Turner's Falls, Massachusetts. Lenore.
Hi. My question's similar to the one before me, but how do you feel, or is there any recent news on, I guess, benzodiazepines and dementia, like taking Ambien? And sleep is a big problem for me, so I take trazodone, but I don't really like it's not good enough for me.
Well, I think the same sort of thing is true with the benzodiazepines. So these are medicines like Ativan and Valium. And these are medicines that are good for quieting anxiety. They're good for making people a little bit drowsy. But unfortunately, a lot of these medicines are very lipid-soluble. And what that means is that they penetrate into the brain very easily, but they stick around in the brain for a long time. And so these medicines that may have an anxiety effect or a drowsiness effect for, you know, minutes or hours may have cognitive effects for much longer than that. The benzodiazepines are sedatives. They work in part by suppressing brain activity, sort of. And so that's, if somebody has memory difficulties, that's certainly something we want to avoid if possible. Sometimes you have to use it. We know that sleep is important for people who have memory difficulties and for those of us who don't. And so you have to do something that works. You have to get enough sleep to be able to be functional. But if it's possible to do so without the benzos, then that's definitely a better way of doing it.
Thank you. And now, let's see here. Yes, on to Sarah in Albany, but not before. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Your chances of getting in right now are excellent. Sarah in Albany. Go, Sarah.
Oh, hello. Good afternoon, and thank you for the call. Dementia and Alzheimer's, what's the difference of the two? And the dementia, if this woman has that, I think she's 89, she's starting, you know, the symptoms, can they be harmful at night to other people in the house if they get up? You know what I mean?
Sure. So the first question, what's the difference between dementia and Alzheimer's? Alzheimer's is
right.
Far and away the most common form of dementia, but it is a form of dementia. So dementia is the overall category. I think another way to think about
is that first you get dementia first, then Alzheimer's?
No, it's more like the relationship between blue and colors. So blue is a color. It's a very common color, but it's not the only color. So about 65% or so of people who have dementia, the type of dementia they have is Alzheimer's disease. Some people have vascular dementia caused by small strokes or big strokes. Some people have dementia caused by Parkinson's. There's dementia from brain trauma, chronic traumatic encephalopathy. There are other kinds of dementia like mad cow disease and other things which are much less common. There's dementia associated with HIV. But Alzheimer's is overwhelmingly the most common form of dementia.
Okay, Sarah?
Well, can they be harmful to other people in the home?
Well, most dementia patients are not dangerous, but there are some people who, as part of their dementia, become disinhibited. They don't have the normal restrictions on activity to obey social norms that we all learn as we're growing up. And some people can become aggressive as part of their dementia. So it's not very common, but when it occurs, it can be a big problem.
Thank you, Sarah. Okay, Doc, before we take a break, which will be any second now, I wanted to ask you, I know that we have heard that both exercise and diet are very important. If you take a walk for 4 miles, is that good?
Doing anything is good. Taking a walk for 4 miles is great. Doing something that gets your heart rate up and builds up a sweat is probably the best thing. Over the last few years, every dementia meeting that I go to, there's another handful of papers or more showing the strong benefit of exercise, benefit in lowering your risk of developing a dementia, and benefit in slowing the progression of dementia. So that's really important. Diet is important as well. People who are eating something like the Mediterranean diet or the MIND or DASH diets, which have less red meat, more seafood, more fresh fruits, nuts, and vegetables, seem to have a much lower risk of developing a dementia.
Interesting. Okay. We are going to take a very short break, and then we'll be back to talk to Mary and David and Judy and anybody else who wants to call. Thank you.
Support comes from Windhorse Naturopathic Clinic, Brattleboro, Vermont, offering naturopathic medicine, oxidative medicine, colon hydrotherapy, and acupuncture. Specializing in Lyme disease, now accepting new primary care patients. WindhorseNaturopathic.com. Ellis Medicine Bariatric Care Center, working as a team to help patients lose weight by focusing on individual goals. EllisMedicine.org/weightloss. Adelphi University's Hudson Valley Center, offering Master of Social Work degree options with flexible schedules at the open house, Tuesday, June 19th from 6 to 8 in Poughkeepsie. adelphi.edu/Hudson Valley. 20 Railroad Public House, Great Barrington, Massachusetts, providing local and seasonally inspired pub fare using antibiotic and added hormone-free meats, local produce, craft beer, cocktails, and wine, 20railroad.com. Adirondack Aquatic Center, Malta, New York, a planned aquatic facility where children and adults with varying abilities in the region can learn, heal, play, exercise, train, and compete. AdirondackAquaticCenter.org. And from Old Castle Theater, Bennington, Vermont, presenting the almost true and truly remarkable adventures of Israel Potter, based on Herman Melville's novel, June 15th through the 24th, OldCastleTheater.org.
Hi, everybody. As promised, we are back with Dr. David Hart of Albany Medical Center, who is discussing with us today dementia and memory loss. So we have Mary comes first, right? Okay, Mary and Troy, you're on. Go ahead.
I've recently been referred to a neurologist. I've been having some disconcerting symptoms. If I have to pick a type of jelly I want on my toast and I have a choice of apple or raspberry, I think I've chosen apple. When I open the jar, it's the opposite. And that is happening repeatedly, and I'm having some weakness on my left side, a slight tremor, and my primary has referred me to a neurologist. So I don't know whether this is psychological cognitive or it is falls under the field of neurology.
Well, it certainly sounds like a reasonable thing to have a neurologist assess. I would say that the picking the wrong jar of jam sounds like the sort of thing that very commonly happens when people are thinking about too many things at once and are a little bit distracted. So I commonly see patients who have that sort of complaint, and that's not very concerning. If you're having some weakness and tremor, some incoordination, then that's definitely something that has to be assessed, and then you have to put the other complaints in into context with that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mary. All right, and now on to David in Monson, but not before the phone number, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Over to David in Monson. All right, David, you're on.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm wondering if you could explain the links of Lyme disease to dementia and Alzheimer's, and if you found that yourself, and how common is that?
I'm not sure that there is much of a link between the two. Lyme is a bacterial infection that can affect the brain. It primarily causes what's called a basilar meningitis, so it causes an inflammation at the base of the brain. And that's why
right.
people who have Lyme often get weakness of one side of the face, Bell's palsy, which is from an inflammation of a nerve coming off at the base of the brain.
Okay, Lyme, I was thinking of the misdiagnosis of like Kris Kristofferson when everyone thought he had Alzheimer's. And then his wife did a lot of research, and then she discovered that it was really just Lyme disease, and they treated him for Lyme disease. And I guess he had pretty good results from that.
I really can't comment on Kris Kristofferson. I don't know very much about his case. I would say that the recommendations of the American Academy of Neurology in terms of what an appropriate workup is generally don't include Lyme testing when evaluating dementia patients. Certainly if you're evaluating...
Okay, yeah, because I thought maybe you'd seen a couple cases, but you're saying you've never actually seen that yourself.
I never have. I think if you're dealing with somebody who comes from a Lyme endemic area, as so many people in the listening area do,
like us, yeah,
it's certainly reasonable to take a look and make sure. But to my knowledge, there is not a strong link there.
David, thank you. All right, on to Judy in Perth. All right, Judy in Perth, you're on.
Hi, Judy. Hi, Alan. Hi, Dr. Hart. A little brief history. I'm 66 years old. I'm very fortunate to be in very good health. I exercise, I try to watch what foods I eat, I try to have as much mental stimulation as possible. My mother did experience dementia. I am a poor sleeper and have been for a long time. I have been reading quite a bit about this subject lately, and now I'm hearing you mention how important sleep is, and I'm wondering if I'm setting myself up for dementia, hopefully in the far future.
Well, I think the one thing that we know for sure about dementia is that it is for most people, it is a multifactorial process. You know, there are a few people, a subset of people who have onset of Alzheimer's before age 60, who have a single gene that determines whether or not they're going to develop Alzheimer's. But for 99% of cases, that's not the case. So I think it's a multifactorial process. There may be some genes of risk. And if your mom had a late onset dementia, if she had onset after age 60, then that ups your risk somewhat, but certainly doesn't guarantee you will get it. And I think that exercising a lot, keeping your brain stimulated, and eating well are all important. If you were sleeping well also, that would be great. And you should do the things that you can do to try and ensure you're getting enough sleep. Trying to avoid screen time for the last couple of hours before going to sleep if you're having trouble falling asleep, thinking about using something like melatonin to help get to sleep. But I think that if you're doing a bunch of controllable things that you can do to lower your risk, if you're not sleeping well, that's unfortunate, but I don't think by any means that's a guarantee that that you're going to get a dementia.
Will melatonin keep you asleep? In other words, getting asleep is a problem some people don't have, like
right.
me. Staying asleep is another
right.
whole matter.
Yeah, melatonin is more something that triggers the sleep process. I have some patients who are able to sleep for a few hours, then they wake up and can't get back to sleep. Sometimes I'll have them take a dose of melatonin at that point.
Oh, that's
if people are awake on and off throughout the night, then the melatonin is probably not going to be the answer.
Uh-huh. Okay, Judy, thank you. Now we'll go to Carolyn in Egremont. All right, Carolyn in Egremont, your turn.
Thank you very much. I was glad to hear David a few callers ago bring up his concerns about Lyme disease, because I've been treated for long-term Lyme and was having a lot of cognitive difficulties that temporarily improved when I was on high antibiotics. Now I'm not so sure that that's maybe the cause. It could be some other sort of dementia. So I wondered, are there any scans or tests that can determine the cause of cognitive problems?
Well, there's nothing that you can do that's similar to bringing your car in and having them plug the computer in and giving you a diagnosis. We're just too complicated for that. There are scans that can show the presence of amyloid in the brain, although they're very expensive and usually not covered by insurance companies. There are scans that can help to differentiate Alzheimer's from frontotemporal dementia, another common disorder. But all of these tests have a false positive and a false negative rate. And there are scans that can show a Parkinsonian kind of process in some patients. But really the best way to reach a diagnosis is to see somebody who works a lot with dementia patients, who knows how to do a workup and look at the common things first and then move on to the uncommon things. And it's important also to determine whether or not having some memory difficulties really is a dementia or whether it's some other process.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you so much for that great answer.
Thank you, Carolyn. All right, let's go to Diane in one of my favorite towns, Hudson, New York. Okay, Diane, you're on.
Hi. I have metastatic lung cancer, and I'm being treated with chemotherapy, and I wanted to find out, because they give me Benadryl each time I get chemo, I've heard about chemo brain and fog, and I've experienced some of that, and I was wondering if there's anything that can be done to prevent that.
I'm not aware of there being a specific mechanism identified through which chemo brain occurs. The chemotherapy agents in many cases target quickly reproducing cells, so that's not the neurons of the central nervous system, which have a very, very low rate of turnover and very small rate of new nerve cell formation. So it probably varies a little bit from one form of chemotherapy to another, what the mechanism might be. There are probably many chemo agents that don't have any association with chemo brain. But I think that the bottom line is that you have to do what you have to do. Your dementia risk doesn't really matter if you don't treat the cancer. And if the Benadryl is necessary to be able to tolerate the chemotherapy, then, you know, I think that your benefits there far outweigh the risks.
Thank you, Diane. Oh. Sorry about that. Let's go to Louise in Salt Point. All right, Louise, your point, your time.
Thank you. I'm wondering if you could tell me what how one tells the difference between normal aging, forgetfulness, and Alzheimer's, and what one can do in addition to some of the other things that you've mentioned to stave it off.
Okay. Well, first off, it's a common result of aging that people have trouble coming up with people's names or with proper nouns. That seems to be age-related, and I can tell you from experience that probably starts as early as the 50s or so. So that's not really a problem. When I see patients who say that, you know, I saw somebody at church and I just couldn't come up with their name, I'm not concerned about that. I'm more concerned if they say I saw somebody at church and I had no idea who they were. It's putting the label on versus identifying what the target that you're trying to label is would be a useful distinction there.
So do we have any idea how far back that goes? I mean, so I get people coming up to me in the street all the time and saying, I bet you don't remember me. And of course they don't. I think that's been happening since I was 12.
Yeah.
So do we know when this thing begins?
Well, I think that it's important to remember that every brain is different and people have different skills, and some people remember every face that they've met. I think that's a great skill for politicians to have, and a lot of them have wonderful face recognition, and other people have other skills instead. So I don't think that, as I say, I don't think that that's anything that's very concerning. I think the process of dementia, the pathologic changes begin, at least in Alzheimer's disease, decades before people develop clinical symptoms.
And, interesting. Yeah. So 12 is not too early.
12, I think, is probably too early for the start of a dementia for most of
us. Thank you, Louise. All right. Let's go to Susan in Napanock. Okay, Susan in Napanock. You're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My boyfriend is 63 now, and he's had a few traumatic brain injuries in the past. He was into motocross and certain extreme sports. He has severe memory loss for certain things. For example, he can remember appointment dates, but if you surprise him and say, quick, name your three daughters, he can't come up with their names. I'm wondering if there's anything that can be done years later for that kind of memory loss.
Well, I think there's probably a couple of layers to your question. Certainly, the best thing for the brain is to not have traumatic injury, but life happens, and you know, many of us do things that put our heads at risk. That's why I am always biting back the urge to shout at people when I'm out on my bike and I see the parents wearing no helmet as they have their kids following behind them wearing the helmets. I think you know, protecting the brain is important. But once you get past that, if something does happen, we don't have great ways of healing the brain. However, when people are having specific cognitive difficulties, sometimes working with a speech therapist who does cognitive retraining therapy might be able to teach them some techniques for generating a list that in their mind that they can get the information they need from, teaching them strategies for how to compensate for deficits like that they're experiencing.
And has there been any success with that kind of therapy years and years after an injury?
Yeah, it depends on the patient and it depends on the deficit, but sometimes learning new strategies can be very effective for compensating for a deficit. I would also say that if your boyfriend has had this as a stable problem for many years, it may be related to the head injuries, but it also may just be the way his brain is wired. And if he's not having progressive problems, then I think that's reassuring.
Thank you, Susan. Okay, let's go to Werner in Stone Ridge. All right, Werner in Stone Ridge, you're on the air.
Hello, Dr. Hart. This is Werner here. I had three chemos and stem cell, and I'll be 77 in July, so I've been forgetting things lately, and it takes like 10 seconds for relays. So has something to do with chemo brain, maybe, which I was told?
Well, that's certainly possible, but there are a lot of other possibilities as well. At 77, you've collected more birthdays than when you were 70 or 71, and there's a little bit of slowing of efficiency of the brain as you age, and that's a normal thing. Having had three different rounds of chemotherapy,
yes.
That's not necessarily great for the brain, but it doesn't also guarantee that there's any specific long-standing problem to your brain that
has come from that. Non-Hodgkin's lymphoma over 12 years.
Okay, thank you, Werner. All right, and now on to Pat in Poughkeepsie, of course. Pat in Poughkeepsie, you're on.
Yes, hello. Hello, doctor. I just recently had to have my partner of 10 years placed in a nursing home because of his dementia, which started showing up 3 years ago. He got very aggressive. And his son placed him, and he's 5 hours away from me. And during the dementia care, I received no help at all. I was on my own. So he had separation anxiety from me, terrible separation anxiety. He would go to daycare, but then I'd pick him up, and he'd be fine. So I was kept from visiting him for a month, and I get different answers from the home. And I was wondering how, because in order to place him, I had to lie and say I was going to see him the next morning, which of course he may have forgotten, but I'm filled with guilt. Do you have any idea how long I could wait without upsetting the apple cart and him wanting me to bring him home?
Well, I think it's a tough question to answer, but I think it's reasonable to give him a little time to settle in and accommodate to the facility as his new normal and as his new home. But I think if it's been a month, then that's probably a reasonable time frame to be able to go back and visit him. It's always a judgment call because you want to be there, you want to reassure your loved one. On the other hand, you don't want to provoke separation
anxiety. Yes, I'm trying not to be selfish because I know a lot of it is for myself as well because we really had no closure.
Yeah.
I was wondering, he loved waiting for the mailman with short notes help. He's 5 hours away from me.
Yeah. I think that that's probably a good idea, and I think it's probably also a reasonable idea to visit him and see how he makes out and find out from the home afterwards what his reaction was like afterwards and time your visits uh-huh. based on that.
Okay, Pat, thank you. Okay, we're going to take this last one before a break, but then we'll have lots more on the last third of the show. Let's go to Sarkis in Saugerties. Sarkis in Saugerties. You're on.
Hi, my question is, I saw something on the internet about a doctor who related that her husband had Alzheimer's, and she researched a lot of different things, and she started using coconut oil to treat him in his food, adding it, you know, to his food, and she saw a lot of improvement. I'm wondering, is there anything to that?
I don't think there's a lot of great evidence in favor of it, and I think it's important to be aware that anything that can have a biological activity can have side effects. There was a trial that we were part of perhaps 10 years ago looking at a sugar from a coconut palm for Alzheimer's, which turned out not to be effective. A lot of us thought beforehand that since it was just a simple sugar, that it was unlikely to have any downside. But it turned out that there was a higher rate of cardiac side effects in the patients who got the palm sugar than those who did not. So even though it seems innocuous, it isn't always.
All right. Thanks, Sarkis. We're going to take a break now, and we'll be back. That'll give us lots of time for the last third of the program. 1-800-348-2551.
Support comes from the Wild Center, Tupper Lake, New York, presenting Pete M. Wire's iForest, an immersive sound installation in a wild forest. WildCenter.org for details. Myron Wine and Spirits, Kingston, since 1960. A wine and spirits shop with thousands of imported and domestic wines and spirits, and staff for questions and advice. Myron Wine and Spirits on Facebook. Capital Roots, making fresh local produce accessible to Capital Region neighborhoods. Healthy, affordable food should be a right, not a privilege. CapitalRoots.org for more information. Bassett Healthcare Network, providing orthopedic care for hip, knee, and other joint pain. Information at FeelBetterWithBassett.com. Soldiers Heart of the Capital District, trauma healing specialists announcing their summer institute, Trauma, Healing, and the Human Spirit, June 28th through the 30th, Saratoga reservations at SoldiersHeart.net. And from Mannix Marketing, Glens Falls, New York, since 1996, a web design and internet marketing firm working to help businesses get found on the internet. ManixMarketing.com.
And we are back with Dr. David Hart of the Albany Medical Center discussing dementia and memory loss, if you're just joining us. In any case, we'll go now to Mary in Kinderhook. Mary in Kinderhook, you're on.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for taking my call. I was interested for a friend in Lewy body dementia, if you could explain the ins and outs of it and what to expect from it and how it progresses.
Sure. So Lewy body dementia is probably the third most common form of dementia, probably somewhere between 15 and 20% of people with dementia. It is related anatomically to Parkinson's disease, and it seems that there's probably a spectrum, and people at one end of the spectrum have mostly motor deficits, and that's Parkinson's disease. People with the same kind of changes in the brain at the other end of the spectrum, though, primarily have cognitive difficulties with some but very few motor findings, and that's dementia with Lewy bodies or Lewy body disease. These patients usually present with some difficulty with memory, but also with severe visuospatial dysfunction. So they have problems with visual processing. It can make them a hazard on the road. People often have difficulties in the office with tasks like drawing.
And how long does it take for it to progress? Or are they different at different rates?
I think that depends a lot on the individual that's being affected. I would say also that another common symptom in Lewy body disease is visual hallucinations, often of seeing people, but sometimes animals or bugs on the wall or things like that. If somebody's having those kind of symptoms early on, then it's much more likely Lewy body disease rather than Alzheimer's disease. The rate of progression, though, varies a lot from one person to the next.
But is there an outside? Mm-hmm. Is there an outside? So, for example, if once you see the first symptom, can it be 5 years or can it be a month? Or
I saw a patient.
Really?
I'm asking him the question.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I saw a patient last year who I diagnosed with Lewy body disease. And when we were talking about the hallucinations, her daughter said, you know, when my kids were young and she used to meet them and get them off the school bus while I was at work, she was always talking about the other kids getting off the bus. But there were no other kids getting off at that bus stop. And that was 10 or 15 years prior. So clearly there was something that was going on well before any other symptoms arose.
So it can take quite a while.
Yeah, I think that's unusual, but there's always a span.
Good call, Mary. Thank you very much. All right, let us go now to, tough call here. Mary, a different Mary in the Hudson Valley. Mary in the Hudson Valley, you're on.
Hi, doctor. Thanks for taking the call. I'm wondering about the depressants that you take, Zoloft. Does that have any memory loss, or and if you take it for a long time, for many years?
Actually, Zoloft is a class of medicine, part of a class of medicines called the SSRIs. And these are depression and anxiety medicines that we very commonly use in treating patients who have dementia because they don't have a lot of cognitive side effects for most people. Many people who have memory loss also have some anxiety or some depression related to that, depending on how aware they are of their deficits. And medicines like Zoloft are often the first thing that we turn to in that situation. So I don't think it's much of a risk. I think it's a good choice in general for treating those symptoms. And in neurology circles, it's a very common medicine to be used.
Oh, well, that's good, because I'm on it for quite a few years because of depression, and that's why I wanted to.
Mary, thank you for the call. Appreciate it
thank
very
you.
Much. Yeah, bye.
Bye now.
Okay, now we'll go to Nancy in Coventry. All right. Nancy, you're on.
Hello.
Hi, Nancy. You're on.
Thank you, and I appreciate you taking the call. There's been a lot of research on Alzheimer's, Dr. Hart, but we're dealing with frontal temporal dementia, the PPA, and
yes.
Other than the descriptors, which we absolutely walk through the park with, where is the cutting edge research for this type of dementia?
Well, there's not as much money being spent on FTD.
It's hard to hear you, sir.
No, I'm sorry. Can you hear me any better now?
Oh, yes.
Okay. There's not as much money being spent on FTD as there is on Alzheimer's, just because it's probably about a third as common as Alzheimer's. But there is a fair amount being done. The Alzheimer's Association has information on FTD research and treatment. We just at Albany Med had Murray Grossman from University of Pennsylvania come up and give grand rounds and see some patients with us. And he's one of the...
Gosh, I'm losing you again. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. I was just saying
I got
that,
where it's one-third as common as Alzheimer's, and Alzheimer's Association has information.
Right. And there are a number of centers like University of Pennsylvania where they're doing a lot of research on, especially on genetic forms of FTD. But that's really where the work is being done at this point.
So,
okay.
So thank you, Nancy. All right. Now we'll go 11. Okay. To Patty in Pittsfield. All right. Patty in Pittsfield, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm wondering if you have any new research on peripheral neuropathy and what medications you might recommend for treatment of peripheral neuropathy. I've been on many, and I'm thinking about trying Topamax and Cymbalta.
All right. Well, peripheral neuropathy, for anybody who's not familiar with it, is a disorder affecting the nerves after they leave the spinal cord. So it's usually primarily a sensory process, sometimes with a motor component. Usually these people have a lot of sensory loss, primarily in the feet, gradually moving up from there. A lot of burning or prickling pain is common, other kinds of discomfort. There's no one medicine that works for everybody who has peripheral neuropathy. Cymbalta is a common one early on to try because it doesn't have a lot of cognitive side effects, and because it's once a day and because the dose titration is pretty simple. Topamax has been used for neuropathy. It can, for some people, produce prickling and tingling in the hands and in the feet. And so sometimes it can be hard to know whether it's helping or whether it may be making things worse. I've certainly had some patients who've been on it and have seen benefit from it. But unfortunately, it's really just a matter of trial and error, trying to find a medicine that doesn't interact with other things that you're taking or won't cause problems for other problems you may have. For example, if you've had kidney stones, then Topamax is not a great choice because it can increase the risk of kidney stones. But it's really just a matter of going through the list and trying to find what works best and is best tolerated by you.
Thank you, Patty. All right, now we're moving ahead fast because I want to try to get everybody in, folks. Let's go to Laura on the Mass Pike. Uh-oh, she was on the Mass Pike. You still there, Laura?
Yep, I am.
Okay, go ahead.
Hey, if somebody has, say, 4 concussions between the ages of 35 and 60, does that put her at a greater risk for dementia in later years? And thank you.
Yeah, I think it's a tough question. Until very recently, it was thought that only prolonged losses of consciousness increased the risk of at least of Alzheimer's disease, that smaller events, smaller concussions, and shorter losses of consciousness probably raised the risk for chronic traumatic encephalopathy. There was a paper just published perhaps 6 weeks or so ago throwing that into question and saying that shorter losses of consciousness were also a risk for Alzheimer's. So I think the bottom line is that the brain is fragile. It's good to take care of it. And the things that occur that are bad for it are bad for it all around.
Doesn't that make you crazy, though, Doc, when you have established knowledge, people have done studies, they tell you one thing, and it turns out, you know, years later, it ain't true?
Well, it can be frustrating. Sometimes it's a difference in the way people look at the data. Sometimes mm-hmm. it's a difference in how the data was obtained. You know, we try and get the best statistics that we can, but was it Twain that said there are lies, damn lies, and statistics?
There are those. So. Thank you, Laura. Okay, let's go to Megan in Delmar. Okay, Megan in Delmar, you're on.
Hi, this is Megan. Megan. I'm trying to be condensed here. 10 weeks ago, almost 3 months ago, I went out to my father's home in New Mexico, and I've been with him for that whole time. And, you know, he was in bad enough shape that I was considering hospice. And, you know, I took him to a psychiatric hospital. I took him to a regular hospital and eventually ended up in skilled nursing. When he left skilled nursing, the advice, I got good advice from people I trust, but no diagnosis, was dementia. So I brought him home and he's like a new person. He's like, he's eating, he's getting around with no walker, he's not falling, he's watching TV, he's reading, he's talking. Like, I'm like, what happened? The only things that I know for sure that changed were we took him off of Flomax and put him on Finasteride, and Xanax was reintroduced because I had taken him off it thinking it was a bad idea. So that's that.
Yeah. So not having seen your dad, it's hard for me to say for sure, but it's pretty common to see patients who are on their own and who are having a little bit of cognitive difficulty that may not be taking care of themselves well. They may not be taking mm-hmm. their medications properly. They may be getting a little dehydrated mm-hmm. or not getting proper nutrition. They may have a urinary mm-hmm. infection or something like that. And all of those things can make somebody who has an underlying mild cognitive problem look much worse.
Mm-hmm.
And so it mm-hmm. may be that that's what was going on with your dad, that when he got into healthcare facilities and they straightened out his meds and gave them to him on the same schedule every day, when if he had an infection, that was cleared up, he was rehydrated and given more stimulation, that may have brought him back to what his best possible level of function is.
Thank you, Megan. Okay, we're trying to get everybody in, so don't be mad at me if we just move along, okay? Let's go now to Mike in Bennington, Vermont. All right, Mike, you're on.
Hi, doctor. Thank you very much. I'm 71 years old, and for 3 years I've been on a generic form of Prestique. It's an antidepressant called desvenlafaxine. And I would really like to go off of it, but when I've tried going off of it or going down the script, it's not that I get depressed, but I have lots of side effects and just feel very strange, get ringing in my ears. And I'm wondering if you'd have any suggestion on that. Or if it's something I just have to deal with my doctor.
Well, it's certainly something that you have to deal with, but it's part of a class of medicines which, if stopped abruptly, can make people really feel miserable. So it's important with that kind of medicine to come down on it very slowly. And if you try and gradually work yourself off over 3 months or something like that, depending on what kind of a dose you're on right now, it might be much better tolerated than if you tried to taper yourself down over a week or 2 weeks.
So in short, to go.
Yeah, I'm on 100 milligrams, so I thought if I went down to maybe 50 for a while and then even saw if I could go down to 25 after that.
I think that's reasonable, but if you went to 50 and couldn't tolerate it, then maybe going to 75 would be better.
And one's doctor really does become important in this, right? Listening to what your doctor has to say about that. Okay, thank you, Mike.
Right.
Appreciate it. All right, let's go now to Pat in Queensbury. I think the third Pat of the program. All right, go ahead, Pat.
Hi, thank you, doctor, for taking my call. My name is Pat. I'm 75 years old, and in August of 2015, I had a traumatic brain injury. I'm very, very, very active. I need to know how much more likely am I to get Alzheimer's because of that traumatic brain injury. And I also had a third nerve palsy. My right eye didn't open for 3.5 months. I drive now. I ride a bicycle again. I did this falling off of a bike. I'm an international bike rider. We were getting ready for our fifth international bike riding trip. And, I mean, how much... I mean, from what you said in the last call, I mean, I'm probably more likely.
Okay, here comes the answer. Go ahead.
Okay.
I think the answer is you're certainly at higher risk if you had a third nerve palsy as part of the brain injury, then clearly you took quite a shot. But increased risk and guarantee are two different things. It sounds like you're functioning at a high level again now, and I think if you're taking care of yourself, if you are wearing a good helmet when you're riding and being careful as far as your riding conditions, if you're getting your sleep, keeping other medical conditions under good control, eating properly, then I think you have the lowest risk that you can have.
Okay,
so that's the best answer,
Pat.
I can give.
All right, let's go to now Fran in Pittsfield. Okay, Fran, you're on. Go ahead.
Hi. My dad had Alzheimer's. I'm 72, and my son suggested using turmeric with pepper, black pepper, with it. Is that beneficial or...
The answer is that we will soon find out. Turmeric has a compound in it called curcumin, and this is an agent which, at least in the test tube, has some effect at inhibiting the aggregation of beta amyloid in the brain. And so that is something which is an early step in the pathologic process of Alzheimer's. So there is a phase 3 trial, I believe, going on looking at curcumin, which is in turmeric, to see if that does have some effectiveness for Alzheimer's or as a preventive agent. I don't know the fine details of the study, but there is some good science to suggest it may actually be of some help, and there's certainly no harm in eating more Indian food.
Thank you, Fran. Okay, and now on to Ken in Hudson. Ken, it has to be a very short call. Go ahead.
Yep, thank you. I was just curious to see what the benefits of omega-3, specifically DHA, versus EPA, and what would the dosage be?
I think the best data suggests that the fish oils and the fatty acids in general are effective when they're consumed from diet and probably not effective when they're taken as supplements. That's anybody's guess why that is the case, but that seems to be a consistent signal in the medical literature that people who are getting their fatty acids from fish do much better than people who are getting them from a jar.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you. Okay, so that's about all we have time for here with Dr. David Hart of the Albany Medical Center. Doc, this has been a great program, and you are very, very smart. It's great to hear your voice and to have you answer the questions. Thanks to underwriting support for Medical Monday comes from WMC Heart and Vascular Institute, with new diagnostic cardiology suites at Mid-Hudson Regional Hospital and Health Alliance Hospitals, members of the Westchester Medical Center Health Network, WMCHealth.org. Thanks again, everybody, for joining us on the Vox Pop, and thank all of you for your wonderful calls. Donna from Woodstock, we left on the phone, and we do apologize to you. Our engineer has been Zach Malloy. Your calls were answered by Joe Makowitz. He's done a great job. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Alan Shartok. Stay tuned now for a little tiny music and then a news update.